Welcome to the Eberle Family Distinguished Lecture Series. For making this series possible, I'm grateful to former Dean Mary Ellen Mazey, Interim Dean Rudolph Almasi, and Professor Donald Hall, Chair of the Department of English, and especially the Eberle family for their generous commitment to education. I'm personally grateful as well to Michelle Marshall of the Department of English, who makes all things possible, and especially to Marcia Bassette, who handled pretty much every detail associated with this event, while somehow always managing every other event associated with the English department. Many years ago, when I was at the University of New Hampshire, I didn't have many opportunities to arrange for lectures. And the first and only person I invited to speak at our campus was the person who will be speaking here today, Professor Donald Pease, the Avalon Foundation Chair of the Humanities at Dartmouth College, founding director of Dartmouth's Futures of American Studies Summer Institute, and star of Big Daddy Don Pease, which you can find on YouTube. Not his top achievement, but I probably shouldn't have put it at the end of the sentence. I spent some time trying to find my introduction from back then, not to save myself the trouble of writing a new one, but although that did occur, but only to highlight the remarkable continuity in the career of a scholar who has done so much to shape and continually reshape the field of American studies. Back then, Don had established the groundwork for this ongoing challenge to the field by responding rather dramatically to an essay critical of what the author called very dismissively the New Americanists, a group of troublesome young scholars that included Don. Don's response was, as I say, dramatic, but it was also quite simple. He created a book series for Duke University Press called The New Americanists. In the years between that talk at UNH and today, that series has produced some of the most innovative, challenging, and influential scholarship in the field. And in those years as well, Don has been a leader and a guide to many scholars, myself included, looking for the promise of what he has called a post-exceptionalist American studies. I'm trusting that most of us are familiar with Don's many publications and edited collections, as well as his important book, Visionary Compacts. And I trust as well that you are anxious to read, as I am, his forthcoming book, Unacknowledged Legislators, State Fantasies from Reagan to Obama. Although I guess the title has changed since then, but trust me, you won't have any trouble finding this one. What you might not know is that Don is a legendary listener. Often a challenging one, always a generous one. At the many lectures presented each summer at the Dartmouth Institute, Don is always the one who asks the question that first summarizes in a few sentences the main argument of the lecture and then raises a question while providing a guiding framework for the answer. My only regret in inviting Don to speak here today is that this means that he is not out in the audience to ask the first question. But we'll have to cover for him as best we can. And I'm absolutely sure that he wants conversation after this lecture. So please join me in welcoming to WVU, Professor Donald Pease.
Thank you so much for that extremely generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. West Virginia University. I want to thank Marcia as well for making all of the accommodations possible, and the English department for making this lecture possible. It's drawn from a book, which is, John has pointed out, I've just completed, which is forthcoming this October. They'll feature it at the ASA, on the role that state fantasies play in the production of compacts and legal identities with the American people. And this is drawn from the last chapter of that book. And since it's recent past that I'm reflecting upon, I'm going to ask you to reflect upon that recent past with me in terms of this concept that I want to call a state of fantasy. It's divided into five sections. The first is entitled Abu Ghraib, the biopolitical unconscious of the injuring state. And I've given you a handout that you can look through whenever you become bored with the talk. Those pictures are sufficiently spectacular to keep your visual interest. The detainees who disappeared into the maze of an unaccountable juridical system and into the cages on Guantanamo Bay represented the other to the people aggregated under the Homeland Security Act. The state proffered this spectacle of sublegal persons being stripped of all rights and liberties as symbolic compensation for the Patriot Act's drastic abridgment of civil liberties. We the people indirectly authorized the state's detainment policies in their dual offices as secondary witnesses to the legality of the governmental operations that accomplished these infernal rites of passage, and secondly, as informal signatories to the discourse of legalized illegality crystallized in phrases like enemy combatants and material witness and persons of interest. But the denizens of the homeland state withdrew their, our, indirect authorization for what went on inside the state security encampments on April 24th, 2004. On that date, 60 Minutes 2 broadcast a series of photographs that displayed an orgy of penal violence perpetrated by military police guards at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. The photographs depicted male and female American soldiers playing various roles in a theater of cruelty that was designed to make the prisoners under their charge feel as if they were extraneous to the human condition. In one of the photographs, a female guard was depicted holding a leash tethered to a dog collar that had been placed around the neck of an unclothed Iraqi man groveling at her feet. Another snapshot represented the same woman, locked in melodramatic embrace with a grinning male MP, standing behind the naked bodies of Iraqi male prisoners who had been stacked on top of one another. Another pictured a guard forcing a hooded prisoner to simulate oral sex with another prisoner. Still another Polaroid represented an Iraqi prisoner precariously perched on a chair with a sandbag over his head and electrical wires attached to his hands. After they were transmitted globally, the photographs of the abuse at Abu Ghraib prison became the space in which the spectatorial public refused the complicities that the security state had solicited. Rather than lending the actions represented in these photographs visual approval, world opinion condemned the Bush administration for arrogating the Homeland Security State the power to violate internationally agreed upon rules of engagement with prisoners of war. If the Abu Ghraib photographs represented the guards exacting retributive violence against the enemies of American freedom, however, why did not the homeland population, on whose behalf the guards reputedly acted, share their visual pleasure in these photographs? The military guards at Abu Ghraib had not, in fact, acted against orders. And Abu Ghraib prison was not an anomaly. Abu Ghraib was one of the manifestations of a distinction the Bush administration had introduced between two different biopoliticized populations. A homeland population that was comprised of citizens who were represented as temporarily dissociated from civil and political rights, and the, in quotes, subhumans that constituted the prison population at Abu Ghraib, who were represented as permanently lacking the right to have human rights. The military prison guards' intercultural relations with their Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib had, in fact, strictly obeyed the regulations spelled out in Bush's biopolitical settlement. The guards' treatment of the Iraqi prisoners established and policed the disjunction between the embodiments of bare life imprisoned at Abu Ghraib and the homeland people. Rather than winning the visual consent of the public, however, the photographs of the horrific means whereby the guards regulated the distinction between these two populations instead opened up a space in between the war on terrorism and the inhuman violence it legitimated that solicited the public's repudiation of this event. The photographs that drew the most notice from the international press were the six photographs taken of a figure that the Pentagon report on the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal designated as detainee number 15. These photographs depicted a hooded man who was made to stand precariously on the edge of a box, sprouting wires from his hands and from under the poncho that covered his torso. The voluminous commentary on this now hyper-canonized photograph positioned the man on the box within a series of pre-existing images from religious and political typologies that memorialized socially sacralized acts of martyrdom. The photographic memories that the man on the box recalled of African Americans lynched during the Jim Crow, of Jesus Christ crucified, reactivated traumatic memories of slavery, the violent history of the civil rights movement, and a sense of venerated self-sacrifice. The historical personages with whom the man on the box solicited comparison would most likely have been unimaginable to the Abu Ghraib guards who took the photographs. But in discussing the family resemblance between the guards' photographs of their victims at Abu Ghraib and the photographs of the victims of lynching taken between the 1880s and 1930s, Susan Sontag characterized both sets of images as, in quotes, the souvenirs of a collective action whose participants felt perfectly justified in what they had done. When they superimposed this representation of an enemy of American freedom upon the photographic memories of persons who had died in their efforts to achieve the freedom in the West, the Western commentators on Man in the Box reconstituted it as the limit figure to the homeland state's visual imaginary, insofar as it brought the United States' official policy of delivering freedom to the Iraqi people into proximity with its unacknowledged technologies of torture. This limit figure brought the spectacle of socially gratifying acts of violence to an abrupt halt. These images also quite literally short-circuited the media relays through which the Pentagon conducted its war of images. At the sight of this short circuit, very different attitude towards the photographs and towards the war began to emerge. But if the image of the man on the box recalled images from the fraught history of the civil rights movement, what about the other photographs? Were the images of the Iraqi prisoners who were forced to masturbate publicly or simulate oral sex with one another solely informed by the information about Muslim phobias that the guards had learned in their one-week crash course on the culture and history of Iraqi Muslims? The phobias, bodily nudity, homosexual touching, appearing naked before a woman, conventionally attributed to Muslim men, may have informed some of the stage settings in which the guards conducted their photo shoots. But some of the poses that the guards forced their captors to assume mirrored sexual and behavioral practices that have in other contexts been represented as possessing an emancipatory social value. Indeed, if they were recontextualized within the manifestos of these social movements, some of the photographs could have been interpreted as expressive of demands for liberation from the recalcitrant order of the male patriarchate or from the imperatives of a heteronormative social order. Upon imposing the bodily practices of gays, feminists, lesbians on Iraqi prisoners who experienced them as the painful imposition of a technology of torture, rather than liberatory rights, the guards turned these emancipatory practices into a means of annulling the Iraqis' way of life. But why did they turn these sexual practices into weapons of biopolitical warfare? Gadri Spivak has suggested a possible basis for the guards having correlated the image repertoire of contemporary social movements with their theater of cruelty when she remarked that, in quotes, "It has seemed increasingly clear to me that terror is the name loosely assigned to the flip side of social movements. Extra state social action, when such movements use physical violence. When a state is named a terrorist state, the intent implicit in the naming is to withhold state status from it, so that technically it enters the category of extra state collective action, more a movement than a state. Terror is also, of course, the name of an affect. In the policy-making arena, terror as social movement and terror as social affect come together to provide a plausible field for group psychological speculation. The social movement is declared to have psychological identity. In other words, making terror both civil and natural provides a rationale for exercising psychological diagnostics, the most malign ingredient of racism, close quotes. With Spivak's observation as warrant, the prison guards in the Theatrum Politicum of Abu Ghraib might be described as having conducted a war of images on two fronts, against Islamic terrorists abroad and against emancipatory social movements domestically. After they harnessed the practices and behaviors associated with feminist and gay liberation movements into the instrumentalities of sexual and cultural abuse, the Abu Ghraib photographs voided these movements of any emancipatory potential. The guards who took these photographs effaced any distinction between the technologies of self-production within emancipatory social movements and the techniques through which they annulled the social ontologies of their Iraqi prisoners. Upon reversing liberationist technologies of emancipatory movements into the machines with which they tortured and abused prisoners, the guards turned the prison into an extra legal sphere maintained by the indistinction between law and violence. Moreover, when they directed the terrorism ascribed to these social movements against suspected Muslim terrorists, the military guards enacted the annihilation of both forms of terrorism. When President Bush invested the American people's collective feelings of grief and rage after 9/11 to a global war on terror, he delegated the emotional authority to act out these feelings to the state's acts of revenge. When Bush enlisted the U.S. public's collective work of mourning into this alternative mode of affective expressivity, he intended to supply the war with moral and emotional clarity. After 9/11, many U.S. citizens felt all right about going to war. But the pictures of these repugnant forms of violence severely complicated the terms of this emotional compact and threatened to shift the balance of emotional authority away from revenge. The interpretive commentary on these photographs marked Abu Ghraib as the site which facilitated the return of national shame from within the very gaze that was supposed to ward it off. Instead of positioning its viewers as subjects who were supposed to enjoy the torture and destruction of an enemy's way of life, the photographs turned the gaze of the spectatorial public inward. The state's response was to change the perspective on this crime scene by representing it as a restricted aberration as opposed to a generalized violation of the law. After describing the photographs as evidence of prisoner abuse, the state reduced its juridical status to that of a corrigible violation of prison rules. However, the photograph shift in the public's visual attitude towards these images also split their spectators into surrogate interrogators of the guards' brutality and interrogators as well of their own reaction to the images of war. This next section is called Cindy Sheehan, Disrupting the State's Emotional Compact with America. Symbolic death usually comes after real death, with the burial of the dead. But the symbolic death of the state fantasy of the homeland took place when Cindy Sheehan, the mother of a soldier killed in Iraq, protested against the war by publicly refusing to mourn in the terms of the state discourse that justified the continuation of the violence. Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, had been killed while on a mission, Sadr City, on April 4, 2004. When she traveled to Crawford, Texas, on August 6, 2005, to set up a camp memorializing the death of her son, Sheehan turned the U.S. public's indignation over Abu Ghraib into the juridical instrument with which she connected the state's official act of mourning with the 9/11 crime scene it was supposed to revenge. After 9/11, the Bush administration drew upon the generalized anxiety and panic generated by this historic catastrophe to declare a state of permanent emergency domestically through the initiation of a global war on terror. The Bush Compact was designed to establish an alliance between national security and the aggressive drives of the U.S. people so as to incriminate dissent as a minor form of treason and to eliminate any loyalty that was more cosmopolitan than the defense of the homeland. The Bush administration forged a justificatory discourse to legitimate the global war on terror. The grounds for its new compact with U.S. populations required the invention of a series of novel symbolic representations, ground zero, homeland, enemy combatant, to accomplish a reorientation of the perspectives through which U.S. citizens were supposed to make sense of the events taking place within the newly organized geopolitical situation. The administration's efforts to solicit the U.S. public's consent to this new compact was accompanied by legislation, the USA Patriot Act, Campus Watch, revisions of higher education Title VI, that regulated the knowledges produced about this new form of governmentality. The legislation that the Bush administration installed to propagate its policies characterized anyone who questioned either this form of governmentality or the discourse that justified it as posing threats to homeland security. The introduction of the signifier homeland to capture this experience of generalized trauma recalled events from the historical archive that it significantly altered. The Bush Doctrine of Preemption can be traced to the colonial adventures of Anglo-American settlers and the forms of warfare in which they were engaged. Whereas the myth of virgin land, which had become the dominant self-representation, produced historical continuity by suppressing the traumatic memory of the lawless violence that colonial settlers had perpetrated against indigenous populations, the Bush administration recovered the memory of colonial aggression so as to reverse the national people's relation to the history of colonialism and imperialism. It foregrounded colonial aggression. The national security state had required that the state dissociate from the history of U.S. imperialism during the Cold War so as to oppose the ambitions of the Imperial Soviet. But the homeland security state's forcible depopulation of peoples from their homelands in Afghanistan and Iraq spontaneously recovered memories of settler violence as the appropriate forms to which U.S. freedom could now be practiced. The state fantasy of the homeland took hold by rendering the U.S. people a captive audience to the spectacular shows of force through which the state violently changed regimes in other people's homelands. The U.S. people's consent to the newly symbolic dispensation assumed the form of our participation in the state's power to impose this newly forged symbolic order upon the populations of Afghanistan and Iraq. The term homeland was the keystone that anchored all of the other terms in the Bush administration's new symbolic arrangement. It performed the double function of structuring the placement of all the other terms, ground zero, enemy combatants, within the new compact, and of serving as the object cause of the homeland security state. The homeland named the locale the security apparatus was pledged to protect and defend against a terrorist attack. But the homeland did not name a place within the social order. so much as the condition produced through the violent desymbolization of the order of things. It was the efficacy of its absence from any locatable place within the symbolic order that enabled the homeland to determine the entire structure of assigned places. The placeholder for a place that was produced out of a violent subtraction from all locatable places, the homeland exercised a structural causality for all of the other terms within the newly symbolized order. Because this compact with the homeland was about who would make the new rules and who would enforce them, it could not warrant criticism of the ethical or juridical values of those rules. Notwithstanding the state's efforts to vilify them, however, increasing numbers of citizens criticized the state's policies. Rather than taking such critiques of its policies and justificatory discourses seriously, however, the administration characterized any criticism directed against its terms as either anti-American or as guilty of violating the memory of the soldiers who had paid the ultimate price in their loyalty to the country. Despite numerous exposés of the administration's rationale, as well as its conduct of the war, the revelation of prisoner abuse in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, the discovery that Saddam Hussein possessed neither weapons of biological destruction nor nuclear devices, the exposure of the fact that the Bush administration had distorted or manufactured evidence to garner public support, the growing numbers of military and civilian casualties, the publication of the Downing Street memo, and despite the fact that more than 50% of those surveyed by the Pew Center expressed opposition to the president's handling of the war, as of August 3rd, 2005, over 50% of the American public continued to support the war in Iraq. Three of the misrepresentations fostered by the Bush administration, that Saddam Hussein conspired with al-Qaeda in the 9/11 bombings, that he trained and harbored al-Qaeda terrorists, and they had weapons of mass destruction, were believed to be true by a comparably large percentage of the U.S. population. However, after Cindy Sheehan traveled to President Bush's home, Crawford, Texas, on August 3, 2005, she set up a camp in which she staged a scene that radically challenged the homeland's legislative authority, and that brought about a drastic shift in the public's support of the war. When President Bush declared war in Iraq, he enlisted the family in the service of the state's militarization. The state normally receives its army from the family, which encounters the limits to its continuation in the state. The young men and women families furnish for war become patriots, who define the values of the nation by sacrificing their lives for those values. The family structure figures the mother as the basis for the reproduction of this state kinship system. Since the state is dependent upon this kinship structure for its emergence and maintenance, the state must expropriate the maternal function from the family and reproduce itself as the security apparatus of the state. The maternal function within the family is displaced and transposed into state security, homeland security. After the state substitutes itself in its security facet for the mother, it sublates the maternal imago within the security aspect of the state. The mother is supposed to show her love for the nation state by sacrificing her progeny to the state for the purpose of its reproduction. On 9/11, the state doubled itself. In one of its aspects, it wore the face of a grieving mother, the Gold Star Mothers, that the homelands symbolized. In its other face, the state bore the terrifying countenance of the patriot who would avenge the mother's losses. At Camp Casey, Cindy Sheehan assumed the persona of a grieving mother within the homeland, but then she dissociated her grief from the militarism through which the state enacted its official work of mourning. In refusing to surrender her feelings of grief to the state's terrorism security complex, she contested the emotional legitimacy of the war. After she refused to cede the state the authority of her sorrow in the name of a child whose death the state had identified as emotional warrant for war, she had characterized her grief as ungrievable in the terms of a militancy that turned grief into a motive for war. In deforming and displacing the homeland state's norms of emotional intelligibility, she brought its emotional compact into crisis. This enactment confounded the symbolic positions that mothers were compelled to represent and refused to authorize the transition from the order of kinship to the order of the state. Rather than aligning her work of mourning with President Bush's justification for the compulsive cycle of retributive state violence, Sheehan's articulation of her maternal grief within the idiom of political dissent introduced an alternative emotional compact. When Sheehan treated the body of her dead son as the occasion for dissolving her bonds with the homeland, she also transformed Camp Casey into the site for an alternative juridical political order. This next section is called Antigone in Crawford, Texas. When it is not overridden with crises, the symbolic order forms an implicit backdrop to an individual's embeddedness in socially mediated reality. It tacitly informs everyday behavior and understanding. But during times of crisis, inconsistencies within the symbolic order open up opportunities for momentary breaks with its overdeterminations and introduces occasions to separate from its foundational fantasies. Jacques Lacan has described the outcome of this separation as an example of what he calls traversing a fantasy, which he has defined as becoming destitute to the subject positions the fantasy authorizes, literally becoming dead to the subject through whom the fantasy gets reproduced. Lacan has also explained the infrequency of this event by correlating it with the death drive. According to Lacan, to desire something other than the continued existence of the social order is to fall into a kind of death. But to risk this desire, by means of which death is courted, also constitutes the elementary precondition for a truly ethical act. Lacan maintains that there can be no ethical act that does not entail the momentary suspension of the socio-symbolic network of intersubjective relationships that guarantees the subject's identity. This means that an authentic ethical act can only take place if its subject is willing to risk the gesture that suspends the authority of the entire symbolic order. Lacan made these observations in the course of his commentary on Sophocles' Antigone. By defying Creon's edict, Antigone also repudiated the symbolic order of the city that Creon personified. Following her decision to disobey Creon, Antigone was excluded from the symbolic order, and she found herself in a realm in between two deaths, the death of her mandated social position and the death of the symbolic order that had guaranteed its continuation. Slavoj Žižek returned to Lacan's discussion of Antigone to spell out a crucial distinction between the radical aspect of Antigone's ethical act and a merely performative reconfiguration of one's symbolic condition. He's having an argument with Judith Butler. In conducting a war of positions that would turn the terms of the hegemonic field against itself, Žižek explained this distinction. Such a marginal reconfiguration of the predominant discourse would nevertheless remain within the social order, that it would simply reorganize. But Antigone's radical ethical act involved a thoroughgoing transformation of the entire field, in that it redefined the very conditions of socially sustainable performativity. I have invoked Lacan's and Žižek's discussions of Antigone as an interpretive context for Cindy Sheehan's actions at Casey in order to draw attention to the radical dimension of her actions. Like Antigone, Sheehan encountered a deadlock in the surrounding symbolic order. This deadlock assumed the form of a forced choice that compelled her to decide between the state's demand that she bury her dead son in terms that ratified the war in Iraq as the state's work of national mourning, and her felt obligation to grieve him in terms that refused the power to kill the child to the state. Sheehan's way out of the deadlock inspired her to constitute an alternative to the state's juridical and political power. Sheehan's experience of this rupture in between her child's death and the state's demand interpolated her, that's a technical term for hailing her, tethered her, to the traumatic foreclosed dimension of the homeland, the disallowed knowledge of the history of violence condensed within its fatal environment. The state fantasy of the homeland was founded upon this foreclosure. Her experience of being hailed by this foreclosed dimension, this utterly violent dimension of the homeland, opened onto a primal scene that might be described as the underside of interpolation. According to Althusser, interpolation designated a process wherein the positive functional dimension of the state's ideology imprinted itself on an individual so as to subjugate her, him, to the preconstituted order of things. But Cindy Sheehan underwent a process of interpolation wherein an extraneous object in that order, the gap between the homeland and the traumatic element which located what structurally decompleted that order, had instead hailed her. The demand that she herself subjectivize this thing that lacked a recognizable position within the symbolic order plunged her into an abyss of ethical freedom, devoid of the solid ground of social norms and directives that the homeland security state had taken for granted. Sheehan placed the edge of President Bush's Crawford estate under the shadows of the Valley of Death. While sojourning through this domain, she represented her relation to her son as a primordial attachment that exceeded the reason of state. In refusing to take up her proper maternal position within the state fantasy, she lived the equivocation that unraveled the figure of the grieving mother. As we have seen, this maternal figure had been designated the quasi-military responsibility to enforce President Bush's edict, setting the limits to dissent. Do not mourn the deaths of the sons of the homeland in ways that undermine the memory of their sacrifice. By drawing the mother of the homeland state itself into crisis, Sheehan undermined this foundational prohibition of the homeland security state. Her performance of this act of refusal voided her relationship with Casey of the condition of a mother-son kinship bond that the state had consecrated. Her extrication of her son from Bush's cause did not merely result in the dissolution of his and her bonds, it also invoked a juridical realm beyond the homeland's jurisdiction. Like Antigone, Cindy Sheehan's kin emerged at the juncture where her biological blood relationships encountered the state's imagined kinship community so as to detach the one from the other around the more primordial question of the law. Sheehan's speech acts might be described as having emanated from another order of legal rationality that the public reality of her speech acts had presupposed. Although this higher law Sheehan invoked did not have the power to rewrite public law, the incommensurability between the two spheres of law transformed her scene of address into a tribunal of justice. In struggling to give expression to a law of a different order, she grounded her acts in a law that the juridical order did not yet count as law. Speaking in the name of this future juridical order, she performed the legality of what did not legally exist in the form of a law to come, whose claims to justice marked the limit condition of the homeland's jurisdiction. This fourth section is called Hurricane Katrina and the Exodus from the Homeland. In breaking the emotional compact with the homeland state, Cindy Sheehan effected a turning point in the public support of the war. When she began her peaceful occupation of Crawford, 52% of the public surveyed continued to express belief in the legitimacy. By August 15, more than 50% of the United States citizens surveyed expressed their opposition to the war. During her stay in Crawford, Texas, she turned grief into an emotionally legitimate resource for giving expression to grievances against the state. The camp that Sheehan erected at Crawford redescribed the shift from the nation to the homeland in terms of the state's abandonment of the welfare of the people. By speaking on behalf of figures who had been left behind by the homeland state, Cindy Sheehan gave expression to the emotions it disallowed. But it took the landfall of Hurricane Katrina on the city of New Orleans on August 29, 2005, to produce unforgettable representations of vulnerable and homeless people that the homeland security state had abandoned domestically. The Bush administration delayed sending assistance and emergency supplies for weeks after the event. In the days after Hurricane Katrina, the government declared martial law, but had no effective police presence to enforce it. And the people of New Orleans, whom the storm had forcibly removed from their homes and lands, were ignored rather than protected by the Homeland Security state. President Bush sent in a military force to protect private property and to assist and to arrest and shoot the survivors who were struggling to find food and shelter. As an increasingly large military force moved in to forcibly depopulate the residents of their homes, it appeared to these observers that New Orleans, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, bore an uncanny resemblance to the city of Baghdad following the U.S. invasion. Hurricane Katrina had representationally dissevered the U.S. people's bond with Bush's homeland state by revealing how the administration had reneged on the core premise that was crucial to the continuation of the compact, to secure U.S. domestic populations through the forcible depopulation of homelands elsewhere. Photographs circulating worldwide in the wake of Hurricane Katrina brought with them unforgettable images of a vulnerable domestic population whose members had been forcibly separated, and of a homeland within the territorial United States that quite literally had been devastated. These images meant that the state fantasy of the Homeland Security state had been drowned in the same waters as the city of New Orleans. Despite the ethical work she had accomplished in exposing these devastating consequences of Bush's policies for the national population, however, Cindy Sheehan was not in a political position to replace this regime with an alternative configuration. Her refusal to take up any of the mandated positions within the homeland had enabled her to traverse Bush's state fantasy, but it took a young African-American senator from Chicago to put an alternative fantasy into place. This last section is called Changing the State of Fantasy. Bush's homeland fantasy depended on U.S. citizens' acquiescence to places within the reconfigured homeland for the continuation of its cultural dream work. But Hurricane Katrina had not merely denaturalized the power of the Homeland Security to acquire the people's consent to Bush's policies. This traumatizing event also brought this national compact to the limits of its providence. Barack Obama inaugurated a presidential campaign that possessed the symbolic force of a constitutional movement. At the level of the law, Obama incited the constituent power of we the people to animate the constitutional power of a movement that redefined Bush's state of exception as a permanent constitutional crisis. Obama inaugurated this movement at the very site where Bush's fantasy was washed away. In The Audacity of Hope, Barack Obama wrote an account of the origins of his movement at the moment of his spontaneous and involuntary recollections of post-Katrina New Orleans at a memorial service President George Herbert Walker Bush led to commemorate Rosa Parks. While listening to President George W. Bush's father celebrate Rosa Parks' memory, Barack Obama recalled images of abandoned and homeless people of New Orleans after Katrina as a site of memory that this memorial service had foreclosed from recognition. He quotes, "As I sat and listened to the former president, my mind kept wandering back to the scenes of devastation when Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast and New Orleans was submerged. I recalled images of teenage mothers weeping or cursing in front of the New Orleans Superdome, their listless infants hoisted to their hips. Stories drifted back from the Gulf that big contractors were landing contracts of hundreds of millions of dollars worth, circumventing prevailing wage and affirmative action laws, hiring illegal immigrants to keep their costs down. The sense that the nation had reached a transformative moment, that it had its conscience stirred out of a long slumber, this could not die away. Obama's spontaneous recollections reversed the effects of the state's official commemorative ritual. President Bush assumed reconciliation between the memory of Rosa Parks and the official state symbols through which she was memorialized. But Obama seized this revolutionary moment that surged up in this space when he linked the image of Katrina dialectically with this montage of associated memories to position this moment of danger as the origin of his movement. The representative of the part of the homeland that had no part to play in the homeland security state, Obama aspired to change America through a radical transformation of three of the grand themes of the fantasy of American exceptionalism: the American dream, perfectible union, and the land of promise, organizing the positionality of U.S. citizens. In undertaking this transformation, Obama identified with the figures who had been accepted, excluded, constitutively removed from the homeland security state, rather than with the state of exception doing the excluding. The tidal shift in the national self-regard that Obama's fantasy engendered was not the result of the restriction of his identification to the homeless people of New Orleans. His movement was grounded in a much more pervasive fantasy of dispossession of citizens stripped of constitutional rights by the Patriot Act, of parents separated from their children by war, of families forced from their homes by the subprime mortgage crisis that was already inscribed and awaiting enactment in the script responsible for the production of Bush's Homeland Security State. He took the integers of the Bush Compact and reversed them. After identifying with the figures who had been structurally excluded, he produced subject positions for the addressees of his discourse to establish symbolic identifications with blacks, gays, the disabled, minoritized ethnics, and other members of the internally excluded population. Obama stood in the place of all of the figures who, in having been dispossessed of their positions within the social order, now lacked a place. Desire takes off when its object cause embodies or gives positive existence to the void which animates desire. And Obama, the odd man in, was the embodiment of the void introduced by the U.S. public's heterogeneous desires. As the placeholder for all who could not be constitutively included within the social order, Obama embodied the object cause of the missing America to which we grasp these desires. Born 2 years before Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech in Dreams from My Father, Obama represented his life as itself the outcome of the confluence of heterogeneous American lineages, the immigrant's dream of escape from economic poverty and political persecution, the minoritized American's endlessly deferred dream of one day being included within the American dream, and the white middle class's American dream of future prosperity. And he promised to open up a future for all three of them. The son of a black African father and a white American mother, Barack Obama was raised by his mother's parents in the American heartland, Kansas. In identifying himself as the inheritor of the dream of his father, who emigrated to America from his African homeland in a Lego. Barack Obama also opened up a fantasy space for non-black subjects to imagine their own resilience in the face of impossible global conditions and to hope that things would get better through hard work and resolve. Navigating in between the Scylla of U.S. identity politics and the Charybdis of state fantasies of colorblindness, Obama's constituent movement, his symbolic constitutional movement, started from the ground up. In his autobiography, Obama identified with his Kenyan father's race, but in his movement, he turned this identification into the precondition for building cross-racial relationships by passing them through the complexities of U.S. race politics. He then connected the consciousness of the realities of racial inequality to class and gender issues as the critical precondition for his movement, rather than either excluding whites or validating the entrenched distinction between white Americans and minoritized populations, Obama situated himself in the rift in between these constituencies as the means of perfecting their union. He did so to enable those who are raced, white, to enter into solidarity with people of color in a constituent movement that disrupted previous assumptions about social change. During the primaries, a history that was not of the candidate's choosing unfolded in the deepest recesses of the minds of its viewers. After the airing of an advertisement which represented a white woman rushing into the bedroom of her sleeping daughter after a 3 a.m. emergency call, political commentators accused Hillary Clinton of retrieving a racist representation of black men as terrorizing nighttime intruders that had historically resulted in lynching. Her husband Bill Clinton's comparison of Obama's presidential run with that of Jesse Jackson during the 1980s was likewise condemned for its racist subtext. Jesse Jackson subsequently received comparable public rebuke for failing to recognize the difference between Obama's movement and the civil rights movement of the 60s and 70s, when she needed to justify the continuation of her campaign long after it was clear that she lacked the votes to win. Hillary Clinton delivered a speech in which she impersonated Harriet Tubman, admonishing fugitive slaves to keep running. John McCain ended his speech at the Republican convention by recalling his experiences as a prisoner of war during the Vietnam era. His campaign was premised on a country first platform that was designed to draw correlations between Obama, left-wing extremists who resembled the Viet Cong, and Muslim terrorists in their hatred of America. His running mate, Sarah Palin, personified the ethos of a pioneer woman from the far west. Her self-reliance was expected to appeal to Hillary Clinton's disgruntled supporters. Representations of her willingness to sacrifice her children for her country were designed to render her the antithesis of Cindy Sheehan. But Obama's campaign successfully laid the trans-historical trauma. This is a trans, in that last campaign, there was a transgenerational trauma that was getting acted out. Not just that campaign, there were generations of American traumas that were getting enacted. Not just the Vietnam syndrome, or a whole range of traumas that were getting enacted. But Obama's campaign successfully laid the trans-historical ghost haunting the relations between the generations to rest. Hillary Clinton's prolonged competition with Obama enabled her supporters to work through the issues that separated them from Obama's post-68. The longer Hillary ran, the more 68ers who were still identified with Hillary were able to wean away from their prior attachments. Although McCain recalled the memories of POWs and MIAs from the time of the Vietnam War, his campaign provided him with the opportunity to work through his wartime trauma. McCain publicly accomplished this working through by discovering it happened when he had that parapraxis, or slip of the tongue, my fellow prisoners, that the message his handlers imposed upon him during the campaign was comparable in its impeding his straight talk to the false confessions he was compelled to deliver during his imprisonment in North Vietnam. The turning point in the campaign took place when the subprime crisis enabled the U.S. public to reinvest the credibility they had withdrawn from the economy onto the wish for a transgenerational dream to come true. The need for this fantasy became starkly evident after Bill Clinton described Obama's campaign as nothing but a fairy tale. The public outcry that arose in the wake of this dismissal faulted Clinton for having deprived the country of the empty space of fantasy where U.S. citizens could project their desires and dreams into the consciousness of this public dream. The mirrors that Obama had added to the U.S. political culture did not merely reconfigure the existing field. They also took out the grounds from under the already positioned field, and they brought an entirely different field into view. The acceptance speech that he delivered at the Democratic Convention on August 29th, the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, associated his presidential campaign with the audacious hope for this alternative future. In his victory speech at Grant Park, he associated that hope with the non-synchronous aspirations from 1968. Obama's hope was audacious because it was, and remains, virtually impossible to say ahead of time what the outcome of this hope might be. The speech inspired the courage to act in the face of all the uncertainty that the results from not being able to ascertain the shape of the order which might hope might bring about. Obama has urged the multiple constituencies he has addressed to gather up resolve and prepare to emigrate from involuntary exile within an intolerable homeland and to migrate to a new, as yet unimaginable, America that would appear to be rising up again in the West. Whether or not that state of fantasy is a sign of the audacity of hope or a symptom of cultural despair remains to be seen.